This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out. Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, welcome to the New Books in Israel Studies podcast. I'm your host, Ari Barbalat. Today, it is my blessing and my honor to be in dialogue with Lord Leslie Turnberg. He was a professor of medicine and president of the Royal College of Physicians in England. We are here today to discuss his newly published book, Mandate: The Palestine Crucible, 1919-1939, published in London by Valentine Mitchell, 2021. Leslie, I can hardly thank you enough for your kindness and for your availability.
My pleasure.
To begin, can you kindly tell us about yourself? Where did you grow up? What formative events in your life catalyzed this book and catalyzed the writer you become as an adult?
Born in Salford, near Manchester, in England, 1934, long time ago, in a family where my father was born in Romania, my mother was Austrian and Polish origin, and I was the first member of my family, my older family, to go into university at Old. And we were fairly poor, but not destitute family. And I grew up in Manchester, went to university in Manchester, and qualified as a doctor in 1957. And I worked and trained in Manchester, London, and in America. And I started on a research career while I was in America in 1967. And during that time, I carried out quite a lot of research. And when I came back, I was offered a chair in medicine, a professor fit in medicine in Manchester, which allowed me to do my research, my teaching, and my clinical work. It's like gastroenterology. By then trained in the gastroenterology. And I carried on in university for several years until I became dean at the medical school in the 1980s. I did for a few years. And then at the end of that, I was elected to become president of the Royal College of Physicians in London in 1992, which I continued to do 5 years, living in London then, in the Royal College of Physicians in Regent's Park. Well, that was my medical background. I married my Israeli wife in 1968 while in America, in Dallas, Texas. And we then got married again when we went back to Manchester. And we have two children, Daniel and Ellen. Daniel, our son, was also became a doctor, but was sadly killed in an airplane crash, blighting our lives in 2007. And that made an enormous difference to our lives, losing our precious son. Our daughter went to live in Israel. It's had two kids, of whom two are married and one about to be married. So that's my background. My interest in Israel, leading up to the publication of my first book on Israel, which was Beyond the Balfour Declaration, published in 2017. The reason I became interested in Israel was because of family connection, obviously, but also because when I came into the House of Lords, which I was brought into the House of Lords in the year 2000 by Tony Blair. And the reason he brought me in was because I'd written a report for the government on the health service in London and suggested ways in which health services may be improved. And he liked the report and asked if I would come into the House of Lords to talk about health matters. When I got into the House of Lords, I realized there was a fair deal of antipathy towards Israel. And so it felt to me to be able to try to defend Israel, even though some of the actions in Israel, it's not terribly defensible. But nevertheless, I was in the position of having to say in a good word about Israel, which I've done ever since. But I realized that coming up to the centenary of the Balfour Declaration in 2017, I would find quite a lot of antipathetic comments about whether Balfour did a good thing or a bad thing in creating what he's helping create the state of Israel. So I felt I ought to write a bit of a history of Israel from the Balfour Declaration, which is what I did and published the book, which was basically the history of Israel from its inception right to 2017. And that came out in that war. That really, well, think carefully about the history of Israel. But a lot of research came out in 2017. And subsequently, I realized this was saying a fairly superficial history. Well, I needed to get into more depth. And that prompted me to study the mandate period between the wars, between 1917 and 1939, 1919 and 1949. Those were very critical years for the state of Israel and its formation. And so that's the reason behind me writing this book, about which we've developed some interest.
What message do you hope to convey to readers of this book?
Well, I want to try to indicate that what a miracle it was that the state of Israel emerged for what had happened during those 20 years, 1919 and 1949. The Balfour Declaration in 1917 was not a treaty, it was not a promise, it was not an act of parliament. It was simply the government looking with favour on the idea of a Jewish home in Palestine. That's all it was, looking with favour. And so to go from that to the mandate for Palestine, which in turn allowed Jews entry in Palestine, limited built more, was an enormous step. And to get that message across, that there was a people is given across Europe, mainly in various states, poverty and persecution, being allowed and encouraged to enter Palestine at a time when the Arabs, the Palestinian Arabs in particular, that's only the Palestinian Arabs at that time, were very much against them coming. And the Jews were outnumbered 10 to 1 by the Palestinian Arabs at the time. And the government of the day during the 1920s were vacillating, were uncertain, unclear about whether really this was a good thing. They would be pressed by the Arabs to revoke the Balfour Declaration. Also, by antagonism to the Jews as they came in. And at various times, there were riots. Various times, there were limitations put on the numbers of immigrants coming into it. Palestine at the time. And the miracle is that despite all those things, the Jews were able to establish the basis of what we call the State of Israel in 1948. Those 20-year-olds were absolutely critical. And it turns out that they wouldn't have been able to do it on their own. They had been left for their own resources without the British taking on the mandate for Palestine. It would have been extremely difficult for them to survive against the onslaught of huge numbers of Arabs who didn't want them there at all, didn't want to give them their land, didn't want them to immigrate. And they were very antipathetic to Jews at the time. And they saw a takeover of their land by this foreign body. So the message I want to get across is how vitally important the mandate period was during the period of the Jewish war for allowing the Jews to begin to establish themselves. So by the end of that period, 1949, there were about 300,000 Jews amongst the what they had moved Arabs, even about enough to survive. So that's the message.
What are the primary themes in your book? What argument does your book advance?
Well, there are several arguments. There's been a lot of debate about why Balfour and the British government brought up the idea of allowing the Jews to have some encouragement to set up their own Palestine. This was 1917. The war was on, and Lord George was the prime minister, and Arthur Balfour was the had been the prime minister, but was in the war cabinet. He became interested because Chaim Weizmann had met him and had seemed to convince him that the Jews had a case. Herzl had already suggested Jewish land in Palestine. And Weizmann was the leading Zionist in England at the time. He was in Manchester, where I was. And he was persuading Balfour that this was a good thing. Balfour was the chief cabinet, the government cabinet. And they accepted it for several reasons. One, Chaim Weizmann was an ally who developed a method of producing acetone, which was necessary for production of explosives during the First World War. And it developed a method for producing large amounts of acetone. So they wanted to reward Weizmann for doing that. But perhaps more importantly, they wanted to convince the American Jews to persuade the American president to come into the war on the side of the Allies. So that was a very useful method. But Balfour was more than that. He actually was very clear that the Jews had been badly treated by Christianity in Europe for many wars. And he said as much. He said that we are guilty of being terrible to the Jews for too long. This is necessary. So he was convinced for ethical, moral reasons. And the Balfour Declaration came out. There were two other meetings going on at the same time that people talk about. One was the Sykes-Picot Agreement, which had been reached in 1916 between the French and the Brits, and this was an agreement in secret. Balfour Declaration, incidentally, was public. It was in a letter to Rothschild. It was public widely. It was supported by the French, the Italians, even the Pope supported it, and eventually the Americans supported it too. So it had wide allied support. Sykes-Picot was secret. Sykes-Picot was between the French and the Brits in 1916 to divide up the Middle East if and when the Allies won the First World War. They believed they would, and they would be able to take over the Ottoman Empire in the Middle East and divide it up between the French and the Brits. That was one of the other agreement was even more secret. This was a secret agreement between Henry McMahon, who was the chief minister in High Commissioner, and King Hussein of Hijaz, was Arabia, this agreement was to try to get the Arabs in Arabia to go against the Ottomans, against the Turks, on whose empire this Middle East was run, to revolt against them on behalf of the Allies, the Brits. When Hussein wasn't a very nice man, he murdered all of the Poles. And he was already in trouble by the Turks. The Turks wanted to oust him. So he was keen to work with the Allies. And there was a correspondence between Marne and Hussein promising that if the war was won by the Allies and the Ottomans were ousted from the Middle East, he would then have the whole of the Middle East from right in the north, including Syria, right down to towards Egypt, not including Arabia, Mesopotamia, Palestine, Balkans, Iraq and Jordan, all that would be his. That's what Hussein thought he'd been promised. It's not exactly what McMahon thought he promised. There was a lot of fascination, a lot of underhand activity going on. And that correspondence was never published, because if it had been, Hussein would have been killed by the Turks. But it was never published. And there were a lot of misunderstandings about it. So those were the three events that were going on before the war ended. Balfour, McMahon, Hussein, correspondence, and site people. Of those, only about the declaration of the Puppet Babylon, and it's the only one that survived, because when the war was won, as it was by 1917, General Allenby was all over Palestine and taken Jerusalem in 1917. By then, it was clear that the same McMahon correspondence was not going to hold any water because the French and the Brits had already decided to divide up Syria in the north of the French and Mesopotamia in the south. So that was the position at the end of the First World War. I can stop there for a moment to ask the next question.
What would you like listeners to get out of our dialogue today?
Well, I'd like them to get from the point when the end of the First World War, 1919, was the peace conference in Versailles. And at that moment, the problems of the Jews were degraded or were not since war. Because at that time, they had to, the powers that be, France, Italy, Japan, and America now, that to sort out the after effects of the war. Economies of all those countries were destroyed, or were going to go into a recession in the 1920s and 30s, general strikes. They had to try and make Germany repay all the damage that they had done starting the war. And these conference was trying to sort everything out. Amongst all the various things they were trying to do, was the business of what should happen to the Ottoman Empire, what would happen to the Middle East. And therein lay the problem, because Sykes and Pico, Lloyd George and Clemenceau had already decided they wanted to divide up countries, become colonies of Britain and France. But colonies were going out of fashion. Britain's empire was deteriorating, where the Indian continent was, India was struggling to get out from under the British rule, and the days of empire were gone. And the American president came in and said in his sporting poke on plan that this is Woodrow Wilson. He said that countries, new countries, old countries, have to be self-sufficient. They can no longer be run as colonies. They have to be self-determined. And the idea of mandates came up. Mandates were not colonies. They were run by countries who knew how to run countries until those countries were capable of looking after themselves. So there were plenary arrangements set up until the individual countries could manage their own affairs in modern society as it was. And that's what happened with, for example, with Syria, it happened with Iraq, it happened with Transjordan. It didn't happen with Palestine, because Palestine mandate had been promised. That promise had been confirmed in San Remo in 1922. And then confirmed by the League of Nations in 1923. The League of Nations looked at the promise of a mandate for Palestine and approved it with 51 out of 51 members approving. It was held absolutely by the League of Nations that the mandate for Palestine should include a homeland for the Jews and a new term of the Jews. So those were the background. The San Remo Conference, despite the French not wanting, the French were dead against it, but the Brits won the day, and the League of Nations Conference. But it then went into international law, and although Britain struggled during the next 20, 30 years, particularly the last 30 years, until 1949, struggled with problem of how to separate the warring parties between the Arabs and the Jews. Lots of riots, lots of killing going on. How to separate these warring parties at a time when they had their own problems. Britain had its own problems. But it was stuck with it. It was stuck with it because they take on responsibilities that they couldn't get. They'd agreed with the League of Nations, and they couldn't use it without considerable loss of face, though they stuck with it. And they were able to allow the development within Palestine during the whole of that period of the Jews, despite many reluctance. There were lots of debates in Parliament in Britain trying to revoke the Balfour Declaration. And certainly by 1922, just before the League of Nations in Tokyo, there was a very strong debate saying we really shouldn't be approving this development of Palestine. We shouldn't be stopping this now. But in fact, it went through, and all went through the mandate, went through the League of Nations. And the mandate persisted right until Britain got rid of it in 1948, when they handed it over, 1947, they handed it over to the United Nations. So those 20 years between the wars were very critical, because Britain, under the High Commissioner, was the Edward Samuel, and later other High Commissioners, had to toe the line. They had to try to keep the Arabs or the Jews in line one way or another, very reluctantly, as we said. Sometimes they were on the verge of jettisoning the whole idea and handing it over to America. America wouldn't have done anything with it. They were stuck.
On page 204, you write as follows. The major advantage that the Jews had over the Arabs was the friends they continued to have in high places, particularly in Britain. They included Lord Balfour, Lord Snell, Josiah Wedgwood, Ormsby Gore, and most significantly David Lloyd George and Winston Churchill, whom they had been nurturing for years, plus several Jewish members of the government, including Herbert Samuel and Rufus Isaacs, later Lord Reading. Yet despite the fact that most of them were out of office for much of the 1930s, it is remarkable that they were able to continue to espouse support for the Zionists. The Arabs were very late trying to gain allies in the British Parliament. nor did they have the influential diaspora that the Jews had available. In America after the war, there was a growing pro-Zionist lobby among wealthy Jews who were able to fund much of the development of the Jews in Palestine. Many were in high positions in business, banking, and the law, and tried hard, not always successfully, to influence senior politicians. The power of the quote-unquote Jewish lobby there was always somewhat exaggerated. Then there was the enthusiastic idealism of young, highly intelligent Jews imbued with European know-how who were eager to make a new life. Drive, initiative, and knowledge gave them the tools to make a difference in an inhospitable and threatening environment. The quote-unquote new Jew was a strapping, self-reliant, no-nonsense go-getter who was no one's victim. Little wonder that the poor Felachin, living in a previous century without means or education, could not compete and became increasingly resentful as they watched the takeover of their country. Their masters in the small number of notable families had been well off and well educated, but did nothing to share that well-being with the Felachin in the fields who had been suppressed for centuries under the Ottoman rule. Under the mandate and with friends in high places in Britain and America, the odds had moved in favor of the Jews and against the Arab position. Despite their numerical superiority, the Palestinian Arabs were losing the battle against the influx of eager immigrants armed with modern European technology, financially supported from abroad, and protected by the British. Can you elaborate on this passage for us? What does it reveal about the period that you examine in this book? In what ways does it represent in a microcosm themes that are developed throughout your book?
Yeah, I think, obviously I agree with everything that said, and that you related. Well, it was true that the Jews had considerable advantages despite their numerical inferiority. And they did have friends in my places. It didn't help them in the end. It didn't help them fight up when 1936, about 1939, there was general strikes and riots among the Arabs. And at that time, there were such unrest. And in Britain, there was all fear that the Second World War was about to start. The last thing they needed was revolt and riots and killing. They sent in the army. They did some levels of defiance, but they were clear that this situation couldn't continue. And they decided to have a number of reports, the Field Report Commission, Woodhead Commission, look at how they could sort out this difficulty between the Jews and the Arabs. And Peel came up with, for the first time, an official partition plan to divide the Jewish sector from the Arab sector. The Jews accepted it, the Arabs didn't. It was clear that it was not a terribly good proposal because of the map that they produced. It involved three sections, a Jewish section which was very small and very narrow, an Arab section equally distorted, and the middle section was international around Jerusalem and the long section. So it was a very peculiar division. So the government decided to send in Woodhead to produce another four competition. He produced three plans, two of which members of his own group disagreed with, and again, attention was off the table. By this time, 1939, the government was fearful that they were going to have a Second World War. They wanted to be shot at the whole thing. So they held a conference in London, and they returned, despite the fact that until then, the Arabs had done everything not to collaborate or cooperate if it means all. But they were fighting both the Jews and the Brits, and the Brits were getting fed up with them, but they realized they were all in a difficult position. They knew that coming up was the Second World War. They would need the UNRWA, Muslim population join them in the fight against excess powers and Muslim. And India laid heavily on their mind. So they held a conference in London, which they invited representatives and the Arab representatives. Neither the Jews nor the Arab met together. They had two separate meetings with MacDonald as the foreign secretary, as the colonial secretary there, leading the discussions. In the end, they said, look, you've got to agree to this partition. If you don't agree to it, we are going to hand over the mandate to you, the population of Palestine, and the majority rule will obtain in 5 to 10 years' time when they will decide, the majority rule will decide on immigration and land purchase. The Jews immediately knew this was fatal to them because they were grossly outnumbered still, 2-1, by the Arabs. And if the Arabs then became government, they would not be able to continue in, at the end of 5 to 10 years. And that's how the Arabs, with all their riots, with all their strikes, had won the day. And despite the fact that the Wolves were fed up with them, and despite the fact that the Jews had tried about some old things, and were willing to work with partition plans and so on, the Arabs were rewarded for their aggressive tactics. And that really restored the Jews for a while. Ben-Gurion at the time, the beginning of the Second World War, spoke about, we will fight the war as if there is no white paper. The white paper described as Walton. And we'll fight the white paper as if there's no law, war. It was a terrible time, 1949, because that was when the door to immigration was shut fairly tight from Europe, where the Jews were being persecuted, went out to concentration camps, and eventually to extermination camps later on. And that would be the Holocaust. So during the war, Jewish immigration into Palestine was very limited by the white paper. Wasn't absolutely excluded, but the numbers were limited. And so the end of the 1939 saw a reversal of fortune towards the Arabs, largely as a result of the fact that the Brits couldn't afford to keep running a divided country in that way. They wanted to keep the Arabs and the Muslims from India, particularly on board. So they gave in to Arab bands to be able to run their own affairs. I have to say that that villainous Grand Mufti, Al-Husseini, wasn't satisfied and he demanded more. However, he's no longer in office. So the end of the 1930s saw a reversal of fortune. Until then, of course, there were many episodes you knew about, riots and killing and so on. I can talk about it if you want.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
Speaking of Haj Amin al-Husseini, can you elaborate on the insights your book provides regarding his role in the events that played out during the interwar years? Can you comment on his role in the 1929 riots? Can you comment on his involvement in murders of Arab opponents and of British officials? Can you comment on the circumstances regarding his release from prison? Can you comment on his presidency of the World Islamic Congress? What can listeners and readers learn from you about Haj Amin al-Husseini?
He was a young man who, in his 20s, was quite charismatic. He wasn't typically religious. Hadn't praying and then Iman at all. But he spoke very well. And in 1920, he was very active in raising the voice of Palestinian Arabs against the importance of and he incited the riots which occurred in 1920. And again, 1941. He was, during that time, 1920, the first riot, he was caught and was going to be imprisoned by Allenby, the military commander. But he escaped and went off to bury him. 1921, we came back and Herbert Samuel Butler, by then the High Commissioner, and we gave him an amnesty after the other. And he then decided, because Herbert Samuel was Jewish, he was very suspicious, suspected by the Arabs as being Jewish and therefore Zionist, and therefore Herbert Samuel leant over backwards to try and demonstrate what he was. Them and not bias. And he appointed Husseini as the Mufti of Jerusalem, despite the fact that there were others more suited to that. He became the Grand Mufti over other Muftis. And he then went on to incite all sorts of other uprisings, one in 1921, and then one in 1929. He was clearly a Palestinian nationalist and was almost certainly a severe anti-Semite. His anti-Semitism certainly came out much later, but he was dead against the Jews taking over. He, during the 1930s, was gradually realized as being by the Brits as being antipathetic to the mandate. And so they expelled him, he ran away. He finished up in Germany in the 1940s and became a supporter of Hitler. And he used to raise a lot of propaganda against the Jews and say things like, wherever the Jews kill them. And his propaganda was renewed. And he was clearly a very strong Palestinian nationalist and anti-Semite. He was out of the way for a long time, finished up in the German war, I'll say, then later in France, incidentally, there were plots for having killed by various bombs, but he survived. It's interesting that although he was, I suppose, in a way, the father of Palestinian nationalism, the Palestinian Authority, the Arafat, never referred to him. He was really out of politics. He was a very nasty man. He pulled up his opponents, raised a lot of riots, even though he was not guilty by some of the missions that Britain set up. He was undoubtedly responsible for much of the agitation against the Jews. So, very nasty man.
In what way does your book shed new light on the McMahon-Hussein understandings?
On the McMahon-Hussein understanding, yeah. Well, they were, I described that a series of letters between Henry McMahon, the High Commissioner, and on behalf of the British government, promising and saying that he would lead the whole of war in the East if Britain won the war and relieve the East of the Ottoman. And he would then be allowed to run the whole of Middle East. This was a secret agreement, and it wasn't really an agreement because it was hedged around with all sorts of bits and pieces. And included in the provisos was that this agreement to give him leadership in the early Middle East was to exclude Palestine, Palestinians. The question really arose as to where was Palestine, as it had been up till 1915 part of the Syrian province of the Ottoman Empire. It didn't have a separate boundary. And there was a lot of debate during the 1920s and 30s about where the boundaries of Palestine actually existed. Churchill thought it was the line between Beersheba and Ramallah on the north. But it wasn't that line, because no one quite knew where these places were at that time. But nevertheless, Palestine was explored. And as far as Hussein was concerned, King Hussein was concerned, and his sons, he had three sons, Ali, and brother, and Faisal. And none of them felt much feeling of Palestinian elves. They thought these were very backward people, which they were mainly, apart from the notable families who were very much involved in Turks. And the general Arab population just wanted to get on with their lives. They regarded themselves mostly as Muslim. They didn't involve themselves in Palestine. They were illiterate, they were kept out of education, and they were poor. And so they regarded them as unnecessary. They didn't regard them as being important to keep on in their own empire that they thought of. But the correspondence part seemed to promise that this would happen. Of course, it never could have happened, because the Syrian, for example, didn't want Hussein to be on top of them. They didn't like him. And certainly not people in the rest of Mesopotamia. So, anyway, he was kicked out even of his own country, Hejaz, by King Saud when he came to Saudi Arabia in the 1920s. So we didn't have access to his own country. But that correspondence has stuck in the throats of the Arabs ever since, because they believe that Britain reneged on that promise of saying he came from the whole of the Middle East. They couldn't have done it, because the French had already promised to help Syria, and Britain had already thought they would help Mesopotamia. Incidentally, in 1921, Churchill went across there to Cairo and set up two new countries, Transjordan and Iraq. And they formed in 1921, divided into the sun, and Mesopotamia was divided up in those countries. Anyway, that's the McMahon saga, McMahon Hussein saga. It was a sad reflection of British double thinking. They gave one and took the other. And it was a obfuscation on a large scale. They'd already promised the French to help the Sykes-Picot arrangements. Does that help you?
Thank you. That was a very generous response. I appreciate it. What was the Peel Commission report? Can you describe its ramifications and its recommendations?
Well, the Peel Commission report, 1938, came at the end of a period of riots and violence and strikes, and the Arabs were all over the place. The Jews were defending themselves very effectively, and the Brits brought them. So it was a period of great unrest. Britain were fearful that 1938 was more, so they sent Peel in to look at what could be done, and he came up with the idea of partition, dividing Palestine into two countries, a Jewish and an Arab Muslim part. And he came up with a plan, which I described earlier, a very plan which involved Jews in the north, Arabs in the south, and a peace in between, which was under international rule, including Jerusalem, and a long sliver of land to the coast. And it divided the north from the south, so that anyone traveling across to the rich part in the south as well had to go between that fence, so to speak, and get the water. It was a very common thing, and it would have involved moving a lot of Arabs from the Jewish part, a lot of Jews from the Arab part. It was really not a very good partition plan. And it all back to the British government, they looked at it and thought, well, this is okay, but it's going to cost us far too much money. So they sent Woodhead out to do another plant to see if he could do better. And Woodhead commissioned in 1938-39 and came up with three plans in which they divided the country in different ways. The panel that came, three of them, two of the members said they didn't like two of the plans. So the plans were rejected, and the one that was finally accepted was regarded as far too expensive, so it died the death. But these were the first efforts of partition, and the Jews accepted them. The Arabs said no. The Jews accepted them, even though it gave the Jews a minute control. Some said it was the size of Norfolk when it was debated in the House of Commons and the House of Lords. It's a very small area. So it wasn't entirely satisfactory, but it did give them, for the first time, a Jewish state. And that was without a Jewish state. So it hadn't had a Jewish state before that. It had a Jewish mandate and a mandate on a council, never a state. So saying a state was a big move and was one of the reasons why Hussein objected to it. Although it was very, it was interesting. It was on the basis of partition that the United Nations came up with a partition plan in 1947, which again, the incipient state of Israel, 1948, accepted. But the Arab states didn't, and all that resulted in 1942, truce lines, armistice lines in Jordan took over the whole of the West Bank, and Israel took over the West. So that was partition. New report partition.
What new insights does your book reveal regarding Nahum Sokolov?
Well, Sokolov is an unsung hero of mine, at least, and of many others. There's a Sokolov screen team, and they made another Sokolov screen. He's not very widely known. He was a colleague, a friend of Brian Weitzman, and worked with him in the years leading up to the Balfour Declaration and thereafter. And he was Weizmann's deputy at Palestine at various times. He was Russian, but spoke, I think, 10 languages, a very literate man, who had written a book on the history of Zionism, a book on Spinoza, a highly intellectual man who was responsible, I think, for gaining the approval of the French foreign minister and the French government, the Balfour's Declaration, 1917, before it was produced, before it was announced, he went to France and got the French to agree. He was a great communicator. He then went to Italy, got the Italian government to agree. And he even spoke to the Pope. Popes over the years have not been entirely friendly to the Jews. He convinced that particular Pope that he shouldn't be supporting what they'd been in their aspirations to have a state, making state in Palestine. And he agreed. Then came back and was heavily involved with Weizmann in San Remo and the Bolton's mandate in Geneva. And he was behind the scenes a lot of the time, producing a lot of the ideas and intellectual philosophy of the state and of band. A remarkable man. There's very little written about him. His son, I think, was. He lived for a while in London, very near where I live now, and there is a knee plaque on the wall to demonstrate that he had to live in London. But he deserves more. I thought of writing a book about him, but all the records and most of his stuff are in legal and Russian art, and I don't have a lot of confidence for that I can dig in all out. So, but he is a man that deserves a full biography.
And you describe the origins and repercussions of the Nebi Musa riots of April 1920.
Yeah, this was before, I think it was before Samuel came back, most of them. But there were only two riots, one law. There was a rumor going around that these were intent on taking over the Temple Mount, Al-Aqsa Mosque, from the Arab, and then there was some rumor that he was killing Arabs in Jaffa. There were communists who were having a fight, not a killing fight, but a pistol fight, more non-communist Jews. But this was conflated into the Jews in Jaffa killing Arabs. And this was the propaganda that Husseini, amongst others, was propagating in the Al-Aqsa Mosque in 1920. And the Jews, the Arabs became incensed and ran out in the streets and started a whole host of actions against the Jews. And then there was an event when Jewish lads were playing football, and a football went into the garden of an Arab neighbor, and the Arab got shot, killed. And the Jews were incensed. So there was, again, another certain reasons why the Arabs and the Jews started fighting each other. And there were a lot of killings going on in and around Jerusalem, in Hebron, and in other cities around Palestine. Until, of course, it flagged. And one of the things that happened was that Ronald Stores, who was then the administrator of Jerusalem, under Ernest Samuel, was at a celebration of the Musa event. And he didn't react quickly enough to suppress the riot. And he was forever ostracized by the Jews for having failed to prevent the riot that occurred immediately after that. I think he was ostracized unfairly because while Stores was, in fact, a very important man, he became very friendly with the Jews, and set up chess conferences, chess competitions, which he played, and set up music concerts, which were mainly ruled, and entirely in it. He worked closely with the Jews to set up fronts. He was very involved in ensuring that Jerusalem was protected from devastation by developers, and ensured the city was only built with Jerusalem stone, and any old buildings could only be knocked down with both permission. So he did a lot with Jerusalem. But this business of failing to react to those particular riots stuck with him the rest of his time in Palestine. So that's the background to it.
Tell us about some of the subsequent acts of violence. The Western Wall riots of 1929, the disturbances of 1936, and the Arab uprising between 1936 and 1939.
Yeah, I've spoken a little about the 36 to 39 riots, very much against the Brits as well as against the Jews. But the 1929 was a significant, very significant when separated the 1920 and kept them on to 1929. When after the initial riots, things were beginning to settle down. But other problems fought in that period. Plagues, earthquakes, floods. It was a difficult period. 1929 was the turning point, and it opened into the 1930s, where it didn't settle in the 1910s war, and typically an antagonism. And it arose ostensibly because the Western Wall, where the Jews had long prayed during the battle, Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, and so on, a narrow area in front of the Western Wall surrounded by hovels of Palestinian Arabs and right adjacent to the wall. And the Jews on Yom Kippur put out the reading about a division and temple division between the men and women and brought chairs in and the days on which the foot traveled. And the Arabs objected, saying, look, they're taking over all of Arab and threatening to take over the Western Wall and that they're more up. They conflated what was happening. And the Brits had to take down both these chairs and the dividing field. They failed to do it. They only did it related yet. And the Brits had to come in and remove it against the opposition of the Jews who were praying at the time in Yom Kippur. Well, that set the scene. And the Jews in Jaffa heard about it and decided to walk to object to this. The Arabs immediately reacted and set off a series of devastating riots at which Jews were killed in Jerusalem, old people killed there, in Hebron, there are large numbers in Safed, or where the seminary heroes raided and a lot of the occupants were killed, the buildings were destroyed, and in Jaffa. So the whole thing was horrid. The Jews tried to defend themselves. People like Kapitinsky, man who set up the electrification in Israel.
Nicholas Rutenberg.
Did their best to try and protect them. But it wasn't enough. And then there were lots of problems. And eventually it died down as the Brits eventually brought in their army. A lot of Palestinians were killed, largely by the British army and the police. But it left an indelible mark on the Jews. And particularly the report that came out afterwards, the slow report. The report said, oh yes, the Arabs are to blame. But the reason they're to blame is because they don't like the idea of Jews coming in and taking over. So the whole cause of this uprising was nothing to do with the religious takeover by the Jews of the Dome of the Rock and the Al-Aqsa Mosque. It's all to do with the fact, as portrayed to them by the Arabs, it's all to do with the fact that the Jews were coming in and taking over their land. And the Shaw report said, we really got to do something about stopping this takeover. We've got to stop the Jews immigrating. We've got to stop the sale of money. And that was the big turning point. There was another reporter, Hope Simpson report, pointed out there was nowhere near enough land for the Jews to take. It was needed by the Palestinian Arabs. Mistaken, very badly designed, but nevertheless, something which the government all day thought they needed to take note of. And it was taken up in a white paper, which and it was produced more or less at the same time, saying we've got to limit the number of Jews going, we've got to stop that land being sold to them. And the whole thing created uproar. It was diverted. It was stopped, fortunately, for the Jews by the prime minister of the day, Chamberlain, who said, no, MacDonald, Labour Prime Minister. And he felt that we should not do this. And they rescinded their white paper and produced a sort of report saying, no, we didn't mean that. We didn't mean what we should stop the Jews doing. We really didn't mean that. We got it wrong. We wanted them to continue on the case of the Jews. We sent the letter to Weizmann, who had actually correlated the battle himself with a man called Pendleton. And they sent out a sending letter that Arabs called it the Black Letter. As it brought them back to the Jews were very shaken by that. The Jews realized that they were there on sufferance. They realized that their position was precarious. 90 at Tormenton, or the attitude of Britain and the Arabs to the Jews.
If you don't be asking, how can we appreciate and evaluate the life and legacy of Herbert Samuel in new and different ways in light of your book and your research?
Well, he was an interesting man. He was born in Liverpool, but very well and family, banking family. And he was orthodox in a dock, married, but he lost his religion. Continued. Side, he had produced a paper about the possible state of Jewish state in Palestine until 1915. He was turned down by the then Prime Minister last week. But he obviously had some positive facts, people, interests, well before about the declaration, and he of course supported it. He was out of office when he was made in 1920. He wasn't in the government at the bottom. But he was a very upright man, very moralistic, supportive of the Zionists. But then actually Devil's Fault is equal status, an unbiased ideal when formed by the Muslim. Lent over backwards to support the Arab at that time. But he remained very supportive. Interestingly, his cousin was Herbert Montague, who was actually Montague Samuel, also Samuel. He was also in the government, changed his name to Samuel Montague, from Samuel. And he, instead of being a Zionist, was dead against the idea of Palestine being a Jewish state. He said, if we have Palestine as a Jewish state, all the Jews that have made it in the UK have gone anywhere to the desert, and they didn't know what to do that. But he was dead against it and argued vociferously in cabinet. During the critical time when Balfour produced his declaration in the war, he was sent out in Viceroy to India, where we went by Viceroy to India out of the way, all the Balfour declaration.
As we bring our dialogue today to a close, can you tell us about where your time and attention have gone since completing this book?
Well, I've been writing another book about the Spoken War. I write about the Spoken War in this book. When I came across him while I was writing the Monday book, and I thought he just had some biography. So I've written a biography of him. It will come out in August this year, next month. He was a fascinating man. So he's taken up a lot of my time in search into how he came about. He was born in Ukraine, a Muslim Russian revolutionary, an assassin, who went on to set up the Help War to the Arab Palestine. Irving was a very special plan and set up a Palestine Airways in Naval. So he was a very special man and I've written about it. And since then, I've been returning to my forced of health, and I'm writing the book now on the National Health Service, which of course sees the light of day. Will come out much here, what we are at. So those are what's occupying me in so-called retirement.
As we end today, I'm signing off by reminding you that I am Ari Barbalat, your host today on the New Books in Israel Studies podcast. Today, it has been my blessing to be in dialogue with Lord Leslie Turnberg. He is a professor of medicine and was president of the Royal College of Physicians in England. Today, Leslie and I have been discussing his newly published book, Mandate, The Palestine Crucible, 1919 to 1939, published in London by Valentine Mitchell, 2021.